Good evening. Is Brexit broken? Boris Johnson's dream crashes and burns. A hacktivist is moved to the same jail as Chelsea Manning. Are more espionage charges on the way? And guns in Walmart, the end of an affair. With those and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo and the news for Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. In Great Britain, Boris Johnson's attempt to trigger a general election has been thwarted after failing to achieve a two-thirds majority on Wednesday night. The opposition has nothing to gain from a new election, and they have the votes to block a no-deal Brexit. The Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, and the Scottish National Party abstained from the vote. The vote occurred after a raucous debate in the House of Commons. Justin Matters is a Labour Party member of Parliament. He says Brexit could cut 10% off the British economy.
If anyone had said a year ago that's where we would find ourselves, I wouldn't have believed you. But such is the reckless ideological madness that we have on the benches opposite, that is exactly where we are today. The Prime Minister tells us that he cannot negotiate with the EU if no deal is taken off the table. But given he claims the primary change he wants to make is on the Irish backstop, which is a very specific issue, there seems to be no connection between the changes he says he wants to make and the need to keep the threat of no deal on the table. And I'm also, as many members here are, at a loss to understand how he can reconcile his statement yesterday that the first thing the EU ask in respect of any proposals made by the government is whether they have the support of Parliament, with his refusal to actually share his proposals with Parliament. How can he say we would support his proposals if we don't even know what they are?
But Conservative MP Stephen Barclay argues that if the decision on Brexit is left in negotiations with the EU, Britain will never leave the Union.
But let me remind the House that President Tusk and others within the EU have repeatedly said that they do not want the UK to leave. Indeed, he said if a deal is impossible and no one wants no deal, then who will finally have the courage to say what the only positive solution is? So let's not be in any doubt. Those on the other side of the negotiation do not want the UK to leave. They don't want to lose the 12% of the financial contribution to the EU budget that the United Kingdom pays, the £1 billion a month that this extension will cause, and therefore, in short, there will be no incentive for the EU to move. And this, in practice, will be legislation that will act as purgatory and endless delay. I'll happily give way.
A sentiment echoed by the Prime Minister.
It's a bill that effectively ends the negotiations, a bill that demands an extension at least until next year and perhaps for many more years to come, and a bill that insists Britain acquiesce to the demands of Brussels and hands control to our partners. It's a bill designed to overturn the biggest democratic vote in our history, the 2016 referendum.
But Labour Party head Jeremy Corbyn slammed Johnson's point of view. Brexit, he says, was supposed to be an orderly parting, not a headlong rush.
And the naked truth is that the reality is deeply unpalatable. A disastrous no-deal Brexit to take us into the arms of a trade deal with Donald Trump that will put America first and Britain a distant second. The Prime Minister knows there is no mandate for no deal, no majority support for it in the country, and no majority for it in this House. The Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, the co-convener of the Vote Leave campaign, said in March this year, "We didn't vote to leave without a deal." Even the leaders of the Leave campaign are absolutely clear that the referendum confirmed no mandate for no deal. No deal. No deal. No deal. No deal is opposed by every business group, every industry body, every trade union, and by this House, as today's votes and others have shown.
Corbyn adds, Boris Johnson is a liar.
Mr. Speaker, is that this motion from the Prime Minister is about playing a disingenuous game that are unworthy of his office. I look forward to the day his government and his party and all their austerity and misery they've heaped on this country are turfed out of office and we prevent leaving this we prevent this country crashing out on the 31st of October with all the damage he knows, because he's already seen the documents, it will do to people's lives and job prospects in this country. It's a cynical movement from a cynical Prime Minister.
The no-deal Brexit blocking bill now passes on to the House of Lords for debate, where it is expected to be voted through on Friday before going to the Queen's for approval. And in national news, a case growing out of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into charges of collusion by the Trump administration and Russia ended today with the acquittal of prominent Washington, D.C. lawyer Greg Craig. The jury took 4 hours to clear Craig of allegations he lied to the Justice Department about a multi-million-dollar project for the government of Ukraine in 2012. The prosecution, an offshoot of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, was part of a broader Justice Department crackdown on lobbyists who do unregistered advocacy in the U.S. for foreign governments. At issue was a report that Craig was hired to produce on the prosecution of opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko to evaluate the fairness of Tymoshenko's trial and produce a report that Ukraine hoped could burnish its standing in the international community. Craig had worked on President Bill Clinton's impeachment defense, represented former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, and numerous other high-profile figures. Craig also served as an advisor to the late Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Former Trump campaign chair and convicted felon Paul Manafort confessed as part of a plea bargain with Mueller that he helped former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych conduct a media campaign directed against Tymoshenko to undermine the support for her by President Barack Obama. And the American Civil Liberties Union urged ranking members of the House Judiciary Committee to oppose a bill that targets white supremacist groups by criminalizing domestic terrorism on Tuesday. The ACLU said the bill would unnecessarily expand authorities used by the Trump administration to target and discriminate against the very communities Congress hopes to protect. Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, introduced the bill on August 16th amid a growing number of mass shootings in America. Schiff's bill would allow for federal authorities to charge someone with providing criminal support for a domestic terrorist. Providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization is the most frequently used international terrorism charge, accounting for nearly half of federal terrorism-related prosecutions since September 11, 2001. The ACLU said law enforcement agencies already have all the authorities they need to address white supremacist violence. And in more national security news, imprisoned hacktivist Jeremy Hammond, a former WikiLeaks source once regarded as the FBI's most wanted cyber criminal, has been called to testify before a federal grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. The support committee for the 34-year-old Chicago hacker reported Saturday he'd been transferred from his medium security prison in Memphis, Tennessee. Today he arrived in Virginia, where he's expected to be questioned before a grand jury regarding his past ties with WikiLeaks. The anti-secrecy organization's founder, Julian Assange, is being held in London but faces federal espionage charges. Hammond, a dedicated anarchist, is not expected to cooperate with the grand jury, which could land him in jail for a potential 18 more months. Former Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning is in the same jail. She's refused to cooperate with the grand jury. Naomi Colvin is UK project director of Blueprint for Free Speech, an advocacy group for whistleblowers. She spoke with WBAI from London a few minutes ago.
Jeremy Hammond has been called against his will to testify in front of a grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. He is now being housed in the same facility as Chelsea Manning, and what is happening to him is exactly the same as what's happened to Chelsea Manning. Like Chelsea, Jeremy Hammond is a discloser of public interest information, information which constitutes evidence of serious wrongdoing. He was convicted in 2013, just like Chelsea was convicted of her action revealing important information in the public interest. Like Chelsea Manning, the information that he disclosed was published by WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks released the global intelligence files, and this is a collection of emails and other documents from a U.S. private intelligence company called Stratfor, Strategic Forecasting. Stratfor markets itself as a sort of business intelligence firm, but it does also take contracts basically for spying on people. So among the evidence of wrongdoing which was disclosed by Jeremy Hammond was things like Dow Chemical hiring Stratfor to spy on activists who were campaigning for redress for the victims of the Bhopal industrial disaster. Also spying on activists who were planning on staging actions during the Olympics. And I think that was Coca-Cola who hired Stratfor for that. So really quite dubious activities, which we owe Jeremy Hammond a debt of thanks for disclosing. The way that Jeremy's identity became known is that he was turned in by an FBI double agent. Jeremy was a few months away potentially from being released, and what has happened means that he's not going to get out of jail in one way or another for a very long time.
Why is that?
He is likely to be subpoenaed shortly to appear before this grand jury. This is very similar to what's happened to Chelsea Manning, who was subpoenaed to appear before this grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. She was questioned about her communications with WikiLeaks. She refused to testify. She said that she was being asked about things that she had spoken about fully during her trial. As a result of her non-compliance, she's been held in contempt. She can be held for 18 months. Held in prison for not cooperating with the grand jury.
You expect the same thing to happen with Jeremy?
Yes, I think it's extremely likely. I can't really see Jeremy Hammond cooperating with a grand jury. His campaign has said that he's not going to do that. Jeremy Hammond signed a non-cooperating plea deal. He didn't cooperate with the government to get that at that point. I don't think he's going to do it now. He believes in grand jury resistance, so he's not going to cooperate and sort of join in a fishing expedition to punish or pursue prosecutions against activists. Really, in this case as well, this grand jury is basically, I mean, I think we can say with some degree of confidence that it's looking for further opportunities to charge Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher, who is imprisoned in a rather horrible prison in London at the moment and is facing potential extradition to the United States for publishing true information in the public interest.
He was an important journalistic source, and Assange was a journalist, basically, who published material from this source. Assange
That's
has never
right.
been, he's
That's
never
right.
been
sort of,
accused.
So WikiLeaks sort of operates like a wire service in this way, in that they published the material with a description of what it is and some analysis, and form media partnerships. So, yeah, there were an awful lot of media organizations involved in the publication of the Global Intelligence Files. And literally hundreds of stories actually were published based on those files.
It's so they're not going to say that Assange actually helped Jeremy Hammond?
I'm not sure about that. The charge against, the first charge which Julian was laid against Julian when he was expelled from the Ecuadorian embassy in April was that it sort of concerns his journalist source, alleged joint journalist source communications with Chelsea Manning. And it's the kind of thing that if it had not happened electronically, nobody would ever dream of treating as a criminal offence. The source, what's alleged to have transpired between Assange and Manning represents, what he said was, it's like what any honourable journalist would do.
And that would apply to Jeremy Hammond as well.
We can only speculate about why Jeremy Hammond is appearing before the grand jury. Anything that comes out of that, we'll have to see what happens. But what is certainly the case is that Jeremy Hammond disclosed important public interest information, like real evidence of wrongdoing, which we know has been sort of verified by the fact that lots of different news organizations all over the world have published stories on it. And Julian Assange and WikiLeaks was the publisher involved in that.
Anything you'd like to add?
It's very strange, actually, to think about Jeremy Hammond and Chelsea Manning in 2019 sharing the same jail in the east of Virginia. I think that what we're seeing in the United States, I think it's very worrying. We're seeing a concerted pattern of repression. What's happening to Jeremy is exactly the same as what has been happening to Chelsea. Chelsea has been in prison now, for about 5 months on this contempt thing, and she's being fined $1,000 a day for every day she doesn't testify. By the time she comes out of this, she's going to be almost $500,000 in debt. What we're seeing is punitive, it's vindictive, and it's now a pattern. What's happening to Jeremy is exactly what happened to Chelsea, and it's extremely worrying. I don't think that Jeremy's going to be the last either, and this is why it's so incredibly important that we resist Julian Assange's extradition to the United States and that we try and stop it happening. Because if Julian does face prosecution in the United States, I really think that sort of this tide of repression, it's going to become almost unstoppable.
Naomi Colvin is UK Project Director of Blueprint for Free Speech, an advocacy group for whistleblowers. Hammond's potential testimony raises new questions about the scope of the government's criminal case against WikiLeaks. The charges against Assange have thus far been limited to the release of classified U.S. government documents provided by Manning. And in international news, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam announced Wednesday the withdrawal of an extradition bill that sparked months of demonstrations, bowing to one of the protesters' demands in hope of ending the increasingly violent unrest. But activists rejected the decision as insufficient and vowed not to yield until the government accepts other demands, including an independent investigation into alleged police brutality against protesters, the unconditional release of those detained, and greater democracy. The bill would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be sent to mainland China for trials. It has prompted massive protests since June that disrupted transport links and caused the airport to shut down earlier this month. Lam said the government would not accept other demands and instead named two new members to a police watchdog agency investigating police misconduct. In a recorded television announcement, Land said the government will formally withdraw the bill in order to fully allay public concerns. She added the persistent violence is damaging the rule of law and the challenges to the one country, two systems framework under which the former British colony returned to Chinese control in 1997 has put Hong Kong in a highly vulnerable and dangerous situation. She added, our foremost priority now is to end violence, to safeguard the rule of law, and to restore order and safety in society. Lam said it was clear that public frustration had gone far beyond the bill and that her government will seek a dialogue with aggrieved groups to address their discontent. She said she will also invite community leaders, professionals, and academics to examine and advise the government on how to resolve deep-seated problems in the society. Some lawmakers and activists said the move was too little, too late. A youth activist who identified herself only as Chan and wore a helmet and scarf to hide her identity told a news conference that protesters would not back down, not even one step, until their demands are met. She said, if Carrie Lam had withdrawn the bill 2 months ago, that would have been a quick fix, but to apply a bandage onto rotten flesh, that simply won't cut it. Prominent youth activist Joshua Wong said the government in Beijing hopes to cool down the national protests ahead of the country's National Day on October 1st. Pro-democracy lawmaker Claudia Mo mocked Lam's bid to seek dialogue to address public grievances. She's been fast asleep these 3 months. This is just absurd, Mo said. The scars and wounds are still bleeding, and she thinks she can just use some garden hose to put out the fire. And in national news, Walmart said it will stop selling handgun and short barrel rifle ammunition. The retail giant is also requesting customers not openly carry firearms in its stores, even where state laws allow it. The announcement comes just days after a mass shooting claimed 7 lives in Odessa, Texas, and follows back-to-back shootings last month, one of them at a Walmart store. The decision includes ammo used in military-style weapons. Walmart will also discontinue handgun sales in Alaska, where guns are a way of life. A number of gun control activists praised Walmart's moves, but gun manufacturers such as Smith & Wesson saw their shares fall. The National Rifle Association posted a tweet attacking Walmart's announcement as shameful. Igor Volsky is executive director of Guns Down America. He said Walmart's move is a moral victory, even if ammo buyers can still take their business elsewhere.
If somebody is determined to obtain certain kinds of ammunition, they will certainly go to a different kind of store. I'm not suggesting that Walmart's move will prevent entirely mass shootings in this country. Sadly, it won't. We need a combination of the kinds of actions that Walmart took with underlining reform in our basic system, which is why we argue vocally for raising the standard for gun ownership in this country, for requiring people to have a license if they choose to own a firearm, for requiring them to register that firearm. But look, frankly, in the political reality that we're in today, it's going to take some time to get there. And so because 100 people are dying every single day from gun violence, I think that organizing powerful voices in society who have political clout and leverage and can help get us there is significantly important. And the largest retailer in the world, the largest retailer in America, saying clearly that they're now leaning into this issue is pretty significant.
Now, this other thing, they decided to ban people from just walking in there carrying sidearms.
The states that allow open carry, you had numerous instances of people walking in, not only with sidearms, but also with assault weapons on their backs. And oftentimes, as you can imagine, this is intimidating to other folks in the store. This is dangerous. This could has led in the past to simple confrontations becoming deadly and really escalating as a result of the presence of those firearms.
Is that just to make a political point, I can do this, or are they want to bring, like, I might bring my printer in to make sure I get the right ink cartridge or something like that?
Look, I think it depends. I think for many folks who are, I guess, enthusiasts in this area, it's an effort to define norms, to normalize the open carrying of firearms, to make themselves feel more powerful.
What's next?
I think that Walmart has really set a new bar, and we're going to be in the coming days and weeks and months thinking through how to push other large employers to move in the same direction, with the argument being that they have a real responsibility to the folks they employ, to the folks who shop at their stores, to help keep them safe. And so we're going to be calling on American companies to break all financial ties with the gun industry, to stop giving money to political contributions to NRA-backed lawmakers and candidates. I mean, these are people who are literally making their place of business more dangerous by standing in the way of gun reform. I think that American corporations have a responsibility in 2019 to actively lobby for gun reform. They have incredible political connections and leverage, and they should use it on this issue. And finally, I think American corporations need to step up and invest in the communities that they serve. That means help fund gun buybacks all across the country to help get guns off our streets. That means invest in community-run violence intervention programs that are helping reduce gun deaths in American cities. There's a lot that they can do. And I think, with Walmart, in many ways, and certainly the loudest voice in the room leading the way on this, I think other American corporations will do so as well.
Igor Volsky is executive director of Guns Down America. Shares of Walmart climbed 1% Wednesday to its highest level ever. The company is responsible for 2% of firearm sales in the U.S. and 20% of ammunition sales. And finally, Pope Francis acknowledged his growing opposition within the conservative right wing of the U.S. Catholic Church and said in offhand remarks aboard the papal plane Wednesday, "It's an honor if the Americans attack me." Francis commented on critics of his papacy when he received a copy of a new book about his detractors in the United States, How America Wants to Change the Pope. Author Nicholas Senze, who covers the Vatican for the French Catholic newspaper La Croix, presented it to Francis on a flight to Southern Africa. The plane landed in Maputo, Mozambique, late in the afternoon. Francis is on a trip that also takes him to Madagascar and Mauritius. In his book, Senese charts the fierce criticism of Francis among American conservatives who loathe his outreach to migrants and China, his denunciation of free market capitalism, his environmental concerns, and his relaxation of church rides. Rules on the death penalty and sacraments for civilly remarried Catholics. Some have gone so far as to accuse Francis of heresy. The Pope's most outspoken conservative critic in the U.S. include Cardinal Raymond Burke, who Francis ousted as the Vatican Supreme Court Justice, and former White House advisor Steve Bannon. Well-funded right-wing Catholic media amplified their disapproval. Wealthy Catholics are putting money behind initiatives to discredit Francis's allies with the goal of electing a conservative doctrine minded churchman as the next pope. In presenting the book to Francis, Senese explained that he had wanted to show Francis problems with the U.S. Church and how Francis had responded with spiritual weapons. "For me, it's an honor if the Americans attack me," Francis quipped as he handed the book to an aide. The Pope added, this is a bombshell. Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni sought to clarify the Pope's statements afterwards, stressing they came as an informal context and that Francis always welcomes criticism. The Pope wanted to say that he always considers criticism an honor, particularly when it comes from authoritative thinkers, and in this case, from an important country, Bruni said. Francis's fraught relations with the U.S. church hierarchy has escalated in the last year following published accusations by a former Vatican ambassador that Francis had followed others in turning a blind eye to the sexual misconduct of an American prelate, now former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. A church investigation determined McCarrick sexually abused minors and adult seminarians, and Francis defrocked him in February. McCarrick's penchant for bedding seminarians was an open secret within some church circles since at least 2000. The former Vatican ambassador, Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, blamed a scandal on Francis and called for him to resign in an unprecedented attack. Vigano accused Francis of having rehabilitated McCarrick from secret sanctions Pope Benedict XVI opposed but never fully enforced. The Archbishop had ties to the well-funded right wing of the U.S. Church, and clergy and lay people latched onto Vigano's accusations. They questioned his commitment to fighting clergy sexual abuse, although allegations against McCarrick first arrived in the Vatican during the papacy of St. John Paul II. Senesi, whose book is published in France on Wednesday, said he wanted to use the publication of Vigano's claims as a starting point, even though criticism of Francis's papacy has earlier roots, including teaching documents about the environment and the injustice of the global economy. History's first Latin American pope had his own qualms about the U.S. church leadership, which veered to the right during the conservative papacies of John Paul and Benedict, and focused on fighting cultural war battles over abortion and gay rights. Relations took a nosedive in the aftermath of the Vigano affair when several U.S. bishops vouched for Vigano's integrity and demanded the Vatican respond to his allegations. Even the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, called for a full Vatican investigation. To date, the Vatican hasn't released a promised report into this scandal. The U.S. Conference lost further esteem in Rome when it tried late last year to outmaneuver the Holy See into accepting new accountability norms that the Holy See said were legally problematic. Eventually, the U.S. Conference adopted revised norms in June. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Oliver Sampson. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.